20 on computer and 15 on phone. Dave Moak, do you have any announcements to make at the beginning this afternoon?
I don't. Let the games begin.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to the afternoon session of the workshop, Understanding Deep Earth. And we're going to start right off this afternoon with Ray Russo's talk, and I'll give you just a little bit of an introduction to Ray before we get started. He's a geophysicist at the University of Florida, and Ray got his undergrad degree at Brown and a master's and Ph.D. degrees at Northwestern, and he was a postdoc in both Carnegie and in Montpellier, France. And Ray's interested in mantle flow and relation to surface tectonics. And recently, he says, in Chile and Romania, using seismic data mainly. And Ray's taught graduate and undergraduate classes in physical geology, oceanography, structural geology, tectonophysics, terrestrial gravity, magnetism, seismology, and also an interesting-sounding course looking at connections between physical sciences and arts. So his talk for us today is entitled Teaching Deep Seismic Imaging and Tomography to Undergraduates. So, Ray, thanks for doing this. We're happy to have you.
Thanks a lot. Can you hear me in the back there?
Yep. We can hear you all the way in the back.
Great. How do we get going here? There? Okay, I always think it's always a good idea when we're introducing ourselves to have a picture, and so here you see me in my work clothes doing work in southern South America. And I'd like to just say a few words about what this talk is really going to be about. This is not so much a lecture as pieces of lectures that I sometimes give in classes, and there are many ellipses that are going to not be shown. So parts of things that are relevant probably to you, you're not going to hear much about, and in particular, that's because, you know, this is a one-hour thing, and Dave Moak asked me to talk about tomography, which is what the focus is going to be. But I like to start out these sorts of courses, first of all, making sure that the students are not so afraid of things like mathematics that they're going to faint at the first viewing of those things. And in part, the way we do this, or the way I like to do it, is to make it as friendly as possible. And so I really take time to explain these things when they come up in class, and to have them come up in class in a natural way, which is inquiry-based, not so much, you know, here we're going to derive this now so I can show you that, but more like, I want to show you this, and on the way, we're going to have to derive something. So here, for example, is a course goal slide that I sometimes show in classes. We're not going to do this stuff, but in a one-semester class, you can get to a bunch of these things, like, you know, understanding global-scale structures, that means seismic structures, in as much detail as possible, and how these things basically put limits on Earth dynamics currently and on evolutionary scenarios for the Earth. And those are important goals, and they're kind of hard to do, but if you're careful and if you pay attention and if you bring your students along, you can get happily to the end of a course like this with, you know, if not the majority, everybody in tow coming along with you. So let me get used to this procedure here. Okay, so I like to start by asking everybody if they think there's a standard model in Earth science for the structure of the Earth. And usually these students have been through the intro class, although you can do this in an intro class too. Presumably they've got some kind of textbook and there are pictures they're looking at. And the textbooks very often have pictures that look like this. These are two that I've taken from Louise Kellogg et al., a science paper in 1999 on the top, and then one from Paul Tackley more recently in Nature Geosciences. And you can see they're showing sort of this standard 2D cross-section going from the surface down to more or less the coromantle boundary with details that are meant to represent not only the seismic structure, but you've got these arrows which are meant to represent dynamics. This is what's happening. We see things going down. We see things going up. Certain structures like to sink. Certain structures like to rise. And a basic question I like to ask the students, which appeals, of course, to their sense of iconoclasm, is, well, yeah, here it is in a textbook, but how many of these things have we actually really imaged? So we talk about, well, where do these images come from? where do we get images like this? Why do these images appear in important papers and in textbooks? And we say, well, there's a lot of seismic imaging that goes into this. There's a lot of numerical modeling that goes into this. There are geochemical constraints. There are tectonic constraints. I take it as a given that the students have understood about plate tectonics. They've got the basics of that down pat. And so this isn't anything new to them. They understand that, you know, slabs sink, there's subduction zones, and there are spreading ridges, that sort of stuff. But we also like to emphasize that these are interpretive drawings. These really are interpretive drawings. They're not actually what's going on, probably, maybe even anywhere. They may approximate what's going on, but they're not maybe actually what's going on anywhere. And so what do we really know, what can we really say, comes from as the major impetus for this sort of class. All right, so I try to knock the students off their complacent first of saying, well, you know, a lot of this stuff is known, and it's a given, and I don't really have to think too much about it. I'm going to take your word for it, old professor guy, that, you know, we want to do this. This is something good to do. Instead, what I like to do is motivate the discussions by showing them, at least right off the bat, that there are very few things, actually, that we can say directly. Direct observation is incredibly limited. We don't have many surface exposures. Those are rare. They don't take us down very far. Mines are pathetic. Drilling is not very good. So if we want to see inside the Earth, we're going to have to do some work. We can see sort of certain things. We can draw certain inferences. And I also like to bring in the inferential logic that we use so much in geology and geophysics in this little exercise. What do we know indirectly? So I tell them that, you know, from the gravitational attraction of the planet, we can determine the mass of the Earth. We know very well the mass of satellites that we loft into orbit. And we get this number. This is the mass of the Earth. We can also determine the radius. And assuming that we've got a spherical Earth, which is very good approximation, we can calculate a mean density, 5.5 times 10 to the third kilograms per cubic meter. Now we have a very poignant moment here in Florida where we go outside and we look around for rocks that are 5.5 times 10 to the third kilograms per cubic meter in density. And of course, there are no such rocks. So if you look around anywhere on the surface of the ground, the surface of the planet, rocks basically have densities in the neighborhood of 2.7. For ocean bottom rocks, some people always say, well, yeah, that's true on land, but what about out in the oceans, which is 75% of the planet? And I tell them, well, you can get to 3 maybe. The densest common rocks are around 3.3. So 5.5 for the whole planet, but 3 at the most, more or less, for what you can see at the surface. What do we infer from that? The Earth must have a very dense core, which, of course, everybody already thinks is true, but they've never really thought about why we are telling them that, why they've learned that ever since, you know, third and fourth grade science classes. I like to bring in this particular demonstration early on also because it allows me to sort of get a math problem on the board and also to show them that this isn't a very hard thing. You don't have to panic. If you've had, you know, 1 or 2 semesters of calculus, you can do these sorts of problems. And this problem is about the moment of inertia of the planet about the spin axis. And what you do when you're doing a moment of inertia calculation is you imagine that you've got some little mass sitting out somewhere in the planet, and it sits at some distance, r sine theta from the spin axis. If you take all those r sine theta distances of all the masses in the sphere, and you sum them up, you get a number, and that number will differ depending on whether the mass is concentrated towards the outer part of the planet, in which case the number will be big because you have a big density out here that you're multiplying by a big radius, a big distance from the spin axis. And if you have all your mass concentrated towards the center of the planet, you'll get a smaller number. Okay, so I tell them that. And we look at this equation over here, this equation for the moment of inertia about the spin axis, and we go ahead and integrate it, and I show them that this should be for a homogeneous Earth. If we assume that the Earth is a homogeneous density, rho zero, then we get this number, C equals 8 pi over 15 times rho zero times a to the fifth. And everybody's happy by the time we get there. Now, we can understand this better if we write this C in terms of the mass of the Earth. We just assume it's a sphere. We just assume it's a sphere of radius a, and it's constant density, rho zero. And we plug this ME in here, and we factor out the things that have to be factored out. We end up with a 2/5 times ME times a squared. And if we divide everything by ME over a squared, we get this equation over here, where we're seeing that C over this quantity should be 0.4 if the Earth is homogeneous. The Earth is completely homogeneous. There are no density differences. The number is 0.4. All right. When we launch satellites, we can actually see what this number is. Again, we know the mass of the satellites well. We know their orbits well. We can calculate this C over ME a squared. And we get a number which is less than 0.4, 0.3307. 0.3307, that's less than 0.4. What does that mean? Well, if you remember our picture a second ago, that means that instead of having mass concentrated on the outside of the planet, far from the spin axis, we have to have mass concentrated at the center of the planet, close to the spin axis, close to the center of the planet. And so basically, in this particular calculation, C for the Earth model is greater than the actual C that we determine from satellite orbits. And we can say with confidence there, the mass distribution in the Earth is not homogeneous. The mass distribution can't be homogeneous, and we must have a concentration of mass at the Earth's center. Okay? All right, just for kicks, how many people had trouble following what I just said? You can use these little click things over on the side to give me an idea of how you did. Catherine's good, Katie's good, Suzanne Baldwin, everybody's good, okay. All right, Mike Williams, you're lost.
No, I didn't quite get your, I thought you said how many people had trouble following you, and I was trying to say no.
You didn't have trouble, okay, good.
No.
All right. Great. Okay, so at this point, we've done a couple of things. One is we've established with the students that we can do math in this context, and it's not going to be painful. It's not going to be very scary. And also, we're not going to get a result that is trivial. We're going to get a result which is actually something that we want to know, something that we can use, and something that's going to basically be the predication for our arguments to come. So we've got this concentration of mass in the center, and we can go through whole different arguments about what things must be in the center of the Earth. So we know it has a high density core, and the bulk density of Earth materials is greater than common surface rocks, concentration in the center. So what kind of materials could we make a core out of and end up with that 0.3307 number for, say, for example, the moment of inertia and the right mass of the Earth. All right, I've cut out a bunch of stuff here which has to do with mineral physics. I'm sorry to see that because we have so many mineral physicists with us, but you know those arguments. You can make them. Basically, they go from, I see you, Abby. They go from basically bulk sound velocity arguments, which are maybe a little bit tricky to introduce early on, but you can get there. Anyway, we can say something more elliptical. I told you there were going to be ellipses here. There's a magnetic field of the Earth. We know about this William Gilbert guy from a long time ago. And so we have to think about a core, which is basically going to be some kind of iron-nickel alloy. Silicates aren't good because they're not very magnetic. They're not dense enough. So when we look around the solar system, iron nickel looks like a right choice for us. And we can actually show that to a good approximation seismically, although not in this lecture. All right, so where has our indirect approach gotten us? Well, the Earth's interior is not homogeneous. It seems to have a high density core. We think it might be made of iron, at least in part. The remainder of the Earth looks like it's most likely silicates. And now what? Well, usually at this point, I've posed this question to students in the class, and they say, well, you know, where do all these pictures in your textbook come from? We come right back to that. And we have to basically come up with then some means of doing this. There's a lot of ways you can do these sorts of things, and the one that I was asked to talk about is this tomography. So I introduced elastic waves. Basically, you can, if you understand this, you can kind of forget all about it after we just show this picture here. We need a sudden stress release to generate waves. This leads into a discussion about where do we get these stresses to basically pop off, and we can talk all about earthquakes. Again, there are many lectures that are cut out, and we can instead start thinking about, once we have these waves propagating, what do we actually observe? What do we see when these elastic waves are propagating around the Earth? Well, there are two things. One is time, and so this means really the arrival time of some sensible displacement, some sensible disturbance at some sensor, which presumably we know where that sensor is located and we know its properties, so that we can understand something about the waveforms that these sensors are actually recording here. These are the shapes of the waves recorded in 3D at some sensor. So these two things, time, the arrival time of the disturbance, and the waveforms, are basically all we have to go with for seismology. All right, so again, at this point in this sort of course, I would be going along and doing lots of things about active source seismology. This is explosions and doing reflection and refraction. I would talk all about that and then generalize some of those results to this idea of rays that propagate through the Earth, waves that propagate through the Earth along ray paths, and then finally bring us to the subject that we really want to talk about today, which is this teleseismic tomography that we're all interested in. All right, so it's important for students to understand exactly what it is you need in order to do these things. If they don't get the input data part, then it's impossible for them to actually assess the end results. And that should be really actually true for any scientist, not just students. The observable is travel time. What we're using here is travel time. Some of the more sophisticated techniques recently also use waveforms, but we're not going to talk about that today. That's well beyond what I think most undergraduates could treat mathematically. For these things, in order to know where these waves have been, we need to know something about the ray paths. And if you were listening to Gene carefully yesterday, you heard him say volumes, which is true. The sensitivity to these things are to volumes throughout the Earth. And we need to know these ray paths pretty well, because we're going to associate these times along those paths and try to use that to get structure. All right, what we do in order to fake the ray paths initially is we use this radial Earth model. We have a model of velocities, seismic velocities, both P and S, in the Earth that varies only with radius. So at the surface, there's one velocity for P waves and one velocity for S waves. At 500 kilometers down, doesn't matter where you are, if you're under Asia, you're under the Pacific, again, there's one velocity for P waves and one velocity for S waves, and that's true all the way down right to the center. And we use this radial Earth velocity to establish approximate ray paths through the volumes from earthquakes to stations, and that means we can associate a travel time with parts of the Earth, okay? Now, in reality, when we do this, the station and source distribution is sometimes good, like, for example, with Earthscope. Now, in the lower 48, we're getting some good coverage with that deployment. But more typically, it's actually very poor. And if you think about where seismometers are likely to be, you can get an idea of why that's the case. And also where earthquakes are likely to be, you can get an idea of why that's the case. A lot of areas on the globe, and actually I should say down below the surface, aren't really very well sampled. And I'm not sure we're going to fix that anytime soon. All right, we could get data, we could get these sources of travel times in a couple of different ways. there are catalogs, long-term catalogs, that of travel times, of arrival times, which go back basically to the turn of the last century, early 1900s. And I'll show you some results of those data used to do tomographies. Originally, these data were used to locate earthquakes. And later, the catalogs were basically typed into computers and then put into these big, big inversion schemes that the global tomographers use in a lot of cases to show us those beautiful pictures from the upper and lower mantle. More recently, we can collect our own seismograms, and this can happen a bunch of different ways. For example, the IRIS-GSN, the Global Seismic Network, is a premier instrument for this. This is freely available data. You can download it from IRIS. And once you've got it, you can do anything you want to it, including measuring the arrival times of phases that you think you see or you do see on those seismograms. You might also do something, this is the kind of thing I do, put out regional or local temporary deployments of seismometers. And in a lot of ways, the EarthScope facility is a huge-scale temporary deployment of the kind that we normally do as field seismologists, but on a continent scale. We typically try to do things on a more few hundred kilometer scale, which is a targeted experiment. And of course, there are very important volcano monitoring networks. These are usually of long standing, and they're there to actually tell people when the volcanoes are going to erupt, and there's plenty of data from those, usually for years and years, catalogs of years and years, for those restricted areas. All right, so when we do this, what do we get out of here? I'm sorry to see that my time scale has looked so blurry. At least it looks terrible on my screen, but here's what we do. We've got a bunch of stations that sit on the surface of the Earth, and to these stations we have propagating waves that come up and get to the station. They travel along these ray paths, approximately along these ray paths. And when they come up to the station, we record a time, and then we look at that time relative to the expected time, that's the zero time, for the radial Earth model. So the radial Earth model, that's the velocities only varying in depth, tells us that for a given earthquake to this particular station over here, the time should be X numbered or T, whatever. And in fact, what we saw was something that came in a little before T, almost a second and a half before T. So this would be a path that would be fast. This would be a fast path. We might have some other path like this one here, which is about a second slow. And you can see the swing here between plus and minus 3. That's kind of typical these days for good data. That's typical, I would say, maybe plus or minus 5 seconds at the outside. Now that we've got very good timing from GPS, we can do pretty well with that. In the old days, pre-GPS, you could see swings of 15 seconds, maybe, off the scale on the top and then way down here on either side. And these data were very, very scattered. Now, a lot of that data with poor timing went into the global tomographies that I'm going to show you in a little bit, okay? So bear that in mind. All right, everybody good so far? Give me your thumbs up or whatever if you're following this. Okay, good. All right, why is it that we end up having these differences in time along different ray paths? And the answer is, well, the Earth isn't homogeneous. We already told you that it has a core, and now what I'm going to tell you is it's not radially homogeneous in seismic velocity either. There are blobs down here, some that we know about, some that we don't know about, that have different velocities from the average model. And some of these things, depending on where they are going to be crossed by the waves which travel up to these stations and are going to incur some travel time difference. And our goal here is to figure out, well, where is it along the ray? Where is it along the ray that this green blob really has to sit? Where does this green blob have to sit in order to give us that travel time anomaly for this particular path? And to give us basically this the requisite travel time anomaly for lots of other paths. So the goal here then is to figure out, well, where can we put the green blob and make it work out with all the other blobs and all the other intervening material so that we get a consistent picture throughout the whole mantle, for example, throughout the whole mantle here, that allows us to basically explain all the travel time residuals at the same time. And this, bear in mind, that I'm showing you up here, this is just the residual for one earthquake, right? We're going to have lots of earthquakes, and so we're going to have more paths. And these paths are going to cross, and in crossing, they're going to tell us something about whether or not the green blob could sit at that crossing, or whether the green blob has to be here, or here, or somewhere else, somewhere along that ray path, okay? All right, when we really do this with lots of earthquakes, you can see actually this isn't very many earthquakes. Look over here on the top right. This is something like 5 earthquakes. You can see for maybe 15 stations, you get a bunch of ray paths. The green ray paths are all from one earthquake, which happened over there somewhere off to the right. The yellow ones happened over somewhere off to the left, and so on. And you can see that you start getting a denser sampling. You start getting a denser sampling in certain areas where the rays are crossing. Those are the places where we're going to get resolution, where we're going to be able to say something about the seismic velocities that led to the observed travel time differences that we see up here. And so the paths that cross are going to allow us to define those regions that are always fast, those regions that are always slow, and those that are in between. And in particular, we're going to get some places where we can really get good density of rays, lots of rays all crossing together. And in places like this, we can start seeing geometries of these different velocity anomalies, these anomalous velocity patches. We're going to be able to start defining, their geometry pretty well. Obviously, the more stations we have, the better. And the more earthquakes we have, the better. Now, the beautiful thing about active source and the reason that we start with it in these classes is you choose the geometry. You put the explosions or the vibrosites or the air gun or whatever it is where you want it. You put the sensors where you want them. You record the intervening rays and you're good. For these teleseismic tomography problems, you don't choose where the earthquakes happen. You don't choose when they happen. They happen and you record them if you're lucky. So the geometries here are often difficult. There's another fly in the ointment here, too, which is that because seismic velocity decreases as you get near the surface of the Earth, the rays tend to turn and become vertical. They refract towards verticality as they come up. So what does that mean? That means that as you get near the stations, the rays are vertical and they can never cross. They become parallel and it becomes impossible for them to cross. So you get no resolution. And our rule of thumb in seismology is that your resolution begins at a depth that's about the same as your station spacing. And that was why so many geologists saw red when they heard that the US Array Transportable Array was going to be spaced at 70 kilometers, because that means, hey, we start picking up structure at 70 kilometers, and that's way below the crust and almost everywhere you want to think about, okay? All right, so we very often can't say much about the shallow structure. That's why we do receiver functions. That's why we do active source studies. And those are things I'm not actually going to talk about today. We can talk about those. I know Dave talked about this earlier. We can talk about things like receiver functions as parts of activities, but it's not part of this talk. Okay, so just to make the point about our geometries here. Here's global seismicity for a representative decade, 1990 to 2000. And you see the usual places which are popping off with seismicity. Here's the depth scale. Anything that's red is deep. So you can see the subduction zones very well. In fact, the plate boundaries are extremely well defined, even in 10 years of data these days. The Global Seismic Network is pretty good. But there are huge areas where, if there are earthquakes happening, we're not recording them. And huge areas where there probably aren't really earthquakes, at least usable earthquakes, happening. So big parts of the globe are not going to be sampled for teleseismic tomography. If we look at the station distribution, and here you see in the red stars our favorite seismic network, the IRIS-GSN, the globe is pretty well covered, and the IRIS guys have done an incredible job of getting these stations, functioning beautiful stations, on lots and lots of islands in the middle of the ocean basins. Nonetheless, there are still huge areas, and that's especially true in the southern hemisphere, where we don't really have any kind of coverage. So as Brennan was mentioning this morning, we might do some better work in these sorts of problems, tomography problems, if we had lots of stations out in the middle of the ocean basins. But this is still a difficult technical challenge, something that people are actively working on. All right, when you take the mixture of both the seismicity, where the earthquakes happened, and where the stations are, and you look at an expected calculation of ray density, how many rays could I expect at any particular place in the Earth? This is an old compilation, 1998, Vasco and Johnson, for a couple of different places, for compressional waves, for P waves, in the uppermost lower mantle, 660 to 870. You can see the subduction zones of the world are very, very well represented. But look at the Pacific out here with the log of ray density getting down towards not much. For near the core mantle boundary, it's mostly red, so you're kind of in here. But there are a few places which are pretty good. There are some places which are terrible. What does this mean? This means with our current distribution, or close to our current distribution of seismometers, and given the earthquakes, which we can't change, there are big patches of the planet we're not really sampling very well. All right. So on my screen, this used to be white. The lettering used to be white. I apologize for how it's showing up here. This is a quote from the Byward et al. Paper about global tomography, and I just wanted to give you a sense of the scale of these kinds of inversions. Down to the core mantle boundary, they have 7.6 million travel time, arrival times, basically, from 1964 till 2000 or so. They grouped them together in a bunch of different bundles, 4.5 million bundles. They solved 450,000 unknowns. These are the velocities, the seismic velocities in a bunch of different cells down below the surface, 280,000 cells. Plus, at the same time, they're relocating all the earthquakes that went into this inversion. That's four unknowns. It's the latitude, longitude, depth, and origin time of the earthquakes. And when they do this inversion, it takes about 3 days, or it took about 3 days on this fancy processor they used. This is from catalog data. These are the ISC catalogs, the International Seismological Center catalogs, which are arrivals and waveforms that Byward and company never looked at. Lots of people looked at these from basically the beginning of the 1920s and picked them, but there was no homogeneity in the way they were picked. The timing was often very poor. If you can imagine people in 1950s saying, synchronize your watches and expecting to get good time, you get an idea of what kind of problems were endemic. And so all of that goes into this data, and these are the kinds of pictures you get, okay? They're kind of a standard thing. This is for 270 kilometers depth. It's a map you might recognize, Indochina, Borneo, Australia. Here's Japan. And these numbers are hard to read. It's plus or minus 2% deviation from the radial Earth model. And if you look out here, it kind of looks like a picture of Nebraska in the summertime. You've got all these squares, and the reason for that, it's because Byward and the Utrecht group are honest tomographers. And so what they've done is they've said, where my ray density is low, I'm going to not solve for a very fine grid of seismic velocities. I'm just going to have these big, gross-looking squares in here. And all of that is going to get lumped as one color because I can't really tell the difference. We can't really tell the difference between this part of that blob and this part of that blob. It might as well all be the same as far as the resolution goes, given our distribution of earthquakes and stations. So what can you see? Well, you see these beautiful pictures that provide so much food for thought for everybody. Here is the Pacific lithosphere subducting along the IBM zone and all going up towards the Corals. Here's the Ryukyus and going into the Philippines down there. You can see very nicely the Arakan slab and the Java and Sumatra slabs coming all the way around to Banda. There are some hints at kind of thick lithosphere, basically, underneath places like Australia. But then what about this? What else do we see? It's always suspicious to me that we end up with sort of paired anomalies in these sorts of inversions. A fast anomaly comes with a couple of slow anomalies. And you got to wonder about that. Is that really true, or are those inversion artifacts? Possible that's the case. If we look at these things in cross-section, so where are we? Here's north, and this line is cutting off from the Indian Ocean over here, right across the Deccan Traps, and going up, this is the border with Pakistan and India. Here's Kashmir, here's China and Tibet, and that's the former Soviet Union, Kazakhstan, places like that. What can you see? Here's the cross-section. Notice the scale. It's plus or minus 1%. Plus or minus 1%. That's 1% slow, 1% fast, and depth down to 280 over here on the left. Some anomaly, which they were interpreting as a slow seismic route to the Deccan Traps. Something that looks a lot faster here, which they were actually interpreting as Indian lithosphere, reasonably so. Maybe some indication of a downwarp as you get up into the Pamirs there. These things down here, again, notice the blobby, and especially the vertical blobbiness of these pictures. This, again, is careful tomography, which is putting out right in front of you its uncertainties. I can't tell the difference between here and there, is what they're saying. And what that means is, where the bottom of this feature is anybody's guess, really, right? There's a lot of streaking along rays vertically in pictures like this. Another picture from Byward et al., just to show you some of the things that are going into our standard model. Here is the section line, and you can see it cuts across Sakhalin Island and China. Here's Japan. So all these white flecks over here that look like snow or an image artifact, that's earthquakes. The earthquakes that they used in this are located in this inversion. Here you can see they're defining the slab pretty well, and that this slab actually turns around and gets flat, shallow. Okay, this gets flat, shallow. All right, the scale over here is in hundreds of kilometers. So this is flattening at the upper mantle transition zone, and then it looks like, at least they were interpreting it as resubduction, and then coming down and flattening out and sitting on the core mantle boundary. Okay. Bear in mind again, where we have high, we've got paired low, but not always. They separate out, but they are there. And again, streakiness when we're getting into the mantle, especially the mid-mantle over here, there's not much vertical control over what goes on in the mid-mantle. So these pictures, I would say, are pretty good probably up in here, but anybody's guess really how much of this detail anybody would want to put uncertainties on. All right, here's a global model. Here's a global model which is much smoother. This is in a lot of ways a lot more interpreted than the Byward et al. Pictures. And I apologize to you. I'm a pack rat with these things, and I've forgotten where I've taken this. It might be the UC San Diego group. But what you're looking at are the globe basically at 70, 200, 500, and the core mantle boundary region in terms of, again, the redite and blueite cold. Or actually, I should take that back, fast, seismically fast and seismically slow areas. These sorts of pictures, when you see this kind of picture and you don't see subduction zones, but what you see are slow anomalies where subduction zones are, I always find that kind of worrisome. The biggest anomaly that shows up here is the East Pacific Rise at 70 kilometers depth. And you kind of got the sense you're still feeling parts of that, even down at 500 kilometers depth. Since I don't know what smoothing was actually used here, I would have to say I'm suspicious. I'm a little bit suspicious of this kind of thing. Okay, so I see there's a question for Suzanne from Suzanne over on the side. We've seen plus or minus 1% and plus or minus 5% anomalies. How should the geologists interpret these differences from the radial Earth model? Well, that's an excellent question, and what you should bear in mind is that when you are looking at these large-scale tomographies that come from the catalog data, like the Byward ones I was showing you a second ago, those come with such huge residuals, 10 and 15 seconds, that in order to actually get some kind of smooth picture at all, they have to really suppress a lot of the information that goes in and smooth it and damp it. They damp the inversions. And so what they recover in terms of the anomalies that they recover at the end, it's very, very small fraction of what's actually in the data. When you see a plus or minus 1% P-wave anomaly like that, it's probably three or four times greater in reality, but what you're looking at is kind of the pastel image instead of the saturated image. And nonetheless, as Brendan was pointing out earlier, the tomographers go ahead and saturate those images nonetheless to make you think that 1% is a good spread, but really, in order to get there, they've had to smooth so much that they're leaving out a lot of the real noise and signal. They throw signal away as well when they do these big smooth tomographies. Okay. Did I answer your question? Okay, great. All right, so much for big scale tomographies. What about regional scale things? This is the kind of thing I do. And these are a little bit different in terms of their end result, because the area that you cover is much smaller. You can usually do a better job of resolving certain things, but of course you don't get this global view. On the other hand, you get details of the big pictures, those big kind of cross-sectional pictures, that are maybe important for us to know when we're thinking about whether or not we've got a standard Earth model or not. So the goal here is find some interesting problem, deploy seismometers. The going time period is around 2 years right now. Wait around, record earthquakes, and then determine your travel times. So here's an example. This is one that I worked on, which is why I'm showing it to you. Once again, these looked a lot more beautiful on my PowerPoint than they are looking here, but here we go. This is South America. Here's Patagonia. There's Tierra del Fuego down there. And in this part of South America, there's an interesting thing. The Nazca Plate is subducting north of a triple junction, and south of the triple junction, the Antarctic Plate is subducting. At the triple junction, there's, in fact, this little red line over there is a segment of actively spreading ridge, the Chile Ridge, which is the spreading center between the Nazca Plate over here and the Antarctic Plate over there. And it's spreading at about 5 centimeters a year. So we have this geodynamic oddity of a spreading ridge in the trench. It's right in the trench right now. And previous segments went down the slot 3 million years ago and have subducted, and subducted 6 million years ago and 14 million years ago and so on, and are now sort of out of our picture here. So the basic question we want to know about is, what happens when you subduct a ridge? That's kind of strange. There's plenty of evidence that there's a profound effect on the overriding continent, including, you can see these, I hope you can see these kind of purple triangles, magenta triangles. That's the active volcanic arc that goes along with the subduction of the Nazca Plate, and it quits right there. And the next active volcanoes are here. Down at this latitude, there's a gap of a few hundred kilometers there where there's no volcanic activity. So the ridge subduction pretty clearly messes up the volcanic processes, the arc volcanic processes, and lots of other things go on here too. We don't have to worry too much about that here. And my particular interest was may also be channeling upper mantle flow from the Pacific Basin into the Atlantic Basin. All right, so here's a predicted structure. A three-dimensional structure. We're looking, here's north, there's east. We're kind of looking down on this. The Nazca Plate's in the mustard color, and the Antarctic's in the teal. And here's the spreading ridge between them. And you can see there's that ridge segment that's right in the trench. And what happens when you subduct the ridge, we think, is that you no longer create lithosphere because the temperature rises pretty quickly. So although the two plates are continually spreading apart, this one going 5 centimeters a year down faster than that one, so that its trailing edge separates 5 centimeters a year from the leading edge of Antarctica, you don't create any lithosphere in here, and instead you must open up some kind of a slab window, have a gap. Now, that sort of a gap can't exist, and there can't be a vacuum in there. You've got to basically fill it with something, and what you fill it with is most likely a stenosphere. And our goal with this particular project was to see this slab window, see if it's filled with a stenosphere, and see if the stenosphere is flowing one way or the other from below the Pacific over here into the upper mantle below South America, or vice versa, or something else, right? What was happening? All right, so what do you do? Well, you put down a lot of seismometers. Here they are. Here's the spreading ridge at the trench. These are the predicted locations of what would be spreading ridge if the ridge continued to exist after you subducted it. You have to avoid things like big glaciers, which, although it's colored brown over here, it's actually a pretty significant ice sheet. And here, and once you go past this latitude, the logistics get really difficult. So we couldn't go much further south than there. There are no towns. There's no settlements. As a matter of fact, there are very few settlements in here at all. And put the seismometers out and wait 2 years. All right, after 2 years, December 2004 to February 2007, you can define the world subduction zones pretty well with a network over here. We recorded in those 2 years 1,582 earthquakes greater than magnitude 5. So plenty of data. You can see the green ones over here. I hope you can see the green ones over here are, 5.7 to 6, and all the red ones are bigger than 6. That gives us plenty of energy coming up to the seismic network underneath Chile. What do these waveforms actually look like? Well, here they are before we did anything to them. What are they? We've got a bunch of vertical components. The seismometers have three components. This is the vertical, recording ground going up and down for an earthquake at some particular location. And you can see these waveforms kind of look different depending on where you are, and they certainly aren't lining up. If you look at these lines over here, the lines are slightly offset back and forth. Bear in mind that what you're looking at is many seconds of record down here, so that the offsets in here are going to actually be significant. You also see lots of noise. Look at that, look at that, look at this stuff up here. Some of this is non-volcanic seismic tremor, I'm happy to say, because that was another study we were able to do. But on the other hand, it's not what you want when you're doing tomography, so we filter it out. And here we are after we filtered this out, and you can see a much more coherent set of waveforms of P coming into this particular place. And what we're going to do now is we're going to align them all on this particular peak by doing a cross-correlation. And all that's going to do, it's going to calculate how much shift we have to do to this one up here to make it line up, its peak line up with that one down there. And we're going to remember that number because that's the delay time difference between this station and that station. And that's going to be our input data into our tomography. All right, I want to show you the raw data here in a couple of different ways. And Gene showed you something like this yesterday. Here we have an earthquake which happened back in that direction, and it came to us from the north. And here you see the stations. Here you see this is where the ridge segment is right now. And that's the Chile-Argentina border. You see there's our southernmost stations over there. If you look at the arrival times at all these stations and you contour them, here's the scale, 1.5 seconds fast, 1.5 seconds slow. You can see there's some hint that there's a little bit of fast in there. There's a hint that there's something that's maybe slow over here, but it's not what I would call a really impressive signal. If we look at an earthquake which came from exactly the other direction, it came from the south and was propagating up to the stations, you can see now we've got a little bit of blue up here. Yeah, I don't know, maybe there's something in there. But again, not a very impressive signal. If we look at an earthquake which came from the Pacific, up to these stations, everything is green. This is about the dullest vanilla you can get. All the stations look exactly the same. And maybe that's not so surprising because really what's happening here is some of the stations sit above Nazca Plate. Some of them sit above Antarctic Plate. Some of them maybe sit in the gap, above the gap between those two if there is one. But all of these arrivals coming up from this direction came up perpendicular to the slab. Look at the arrival angle here of 26 degrees. Geologists and seismologists part company here. Geologists plot the inverse of plunge. They plot 90 minus plunge. So we plot vertical, 26 degrees away from vertical. That's about 64 degrees, right, coming up. So that's basically a plunge of 64 degrees in this direction is the dip of the slab. We're coming up vertically to the slab, and we see really not much. This way, when we have an earthquake which comes from Scotia over in southern South America, there, east of Tierra del Fuego, for this azimuth, these waves, these rays travel right up the Nazca slab, and they give us very high. Look at the change in scale here. That's minus 3 seconds to plus 3 seconds. The total swing, observed swing from plus 3 to minus 3 to plus 3, that's a 6 second swing. This is the raw data. You don't have to do much more than this to say there's slab here, there must be something like slab here, and we wonder what's happened there. There doesn't look like there's any slab. All right, we take these arrival times. This is for 4 earthquakes I showed you. We've got many, many more than that. We take all these different arrival times, and we're going to back project them along the rays to those crossing points, to these crossing points in this set of parameterization knots. You're looking at the map here. The yellow area, this yellow area here, is the area, the volume for which we're going to have good resolution. We include a much bigger volume in order to allow some structure to basically go out there if it needs to go out there. But we're only going to look at this volume for interpreting. And within this volume, we're only going to show places where we actually have good ray coverage. Everything else we're going to black out. Okay, here we go. This is the answer. At 50 kilometers depth, this is what we look like. Here's the trench. Here's the ridge segment at the trench. Here's the expected loci of ridge segments if they still existed. And here's our velocity anomalies, plus or minus 2%. Everything that's black, we don't have enough ray coverage to say anything about. And the other places are places where we feel confident we can say something. So what do we see here? Blue, that's the Nazca slab. Here is the slab gap. There definitely seems to be a slab gap. Remember, what we're looking at here is slow relative to a radial Earth model, which already has an asthenosphere built into it. It's got an asthenospheric low velocity built into it. So this is slow relative to that. It's extra slow. There's something really strange going on in this particular location. At 100 kilometers depth, not much has changed. The anomaly's shape is a little bit different. If you pay careful attention, you can watch the center of this Nazca plate anomaly kind of shift to the east, as it should do because it's dipping. It broadens as well. Watch it broaden. This is an artifact of the effect that our rays are spreading out as we go down, and the structure is being distributed over a bigger volume. That's spurious. That's really not true, right? At 200 kilometers depth, that's even worse. The spreading out is even worse. But you can still see something that looks like Nazca plate coming to a sharp end, and then this juxtaposed very slow anomaly here, which we've interpreted as the gap between the slab to the north, the Nazca slab to the north, and the Antarctic slab to the south. Okay, a little bit deeper. Again, things are shifting east for the slab, the Nazca slab, and we're losing resolution. And these are the last pictures we really want to show. After this, the pictures get too green and yellow to actually show kind of anomalies. And the reason for that, again, is our rays are spreading out and our resolution is dropping off to below levels where you feel comfortable interpreting them. Okay? Now, one nice thing about this kind of study is, since we're not talking about a large-scale region the way Gene was yesterday, we're showing basically all of Western North America, we only have a couple of anomalies that we have to worry about. We don't have to say, well, here's the slab, oh yeah, and this blue one over here, we don't really know what that is. We're confined. It's a little bit easier to make the case that you're looking at something that you have resolved. Okay, so we can get some idea of the spreading that we're seeing given the arrays that we've got if we do a synthetic experiment. In this experiment, what we're doing is at 200 kilometers depth, we've got something that we are pretending is going to be the Nazca slab, something that's going to be at the Antarctic slab. We're setting the velocity anomaly to be plus 4%, and in between, we're putting a low velocity anomaly. We're purposely putting a low velocity anomaly there of a few percent, 3% slow. Now what we're going to do is we're going to take all the rays that we used in our actual calculations, we're going to propagate them through this velocity model, and we're going to recover this picture. Okay? Here you can see the widening relative to the actual structure of the apparent output of the slab at 200 kilometers depth. Notice also we kind of exaggerate the result here relative to the input, but now be careful. The color scale has changed on you. This is where tomographers get tricky. The color scale here is plus or minus 2. The input color scale is plus or minus 4. We've only recovered about 50% of the signal here, and we've had to saturate the colors up to make it look better. Got it? Everybody good? Great. Okay. Model input, synthetic output, observed. If you compare these, you can kind of get the idea that, hey, maybe this Nazca slab isn't so fat after all. It might just be kind of a normal width that we calculated here on the basis of expectations from seismicity. This structure, on the other hand, this thing, on the other hand, looks like it's clearly more extensive than in the model. The model is this restricted blob. This thing looks like it's got some tail going off to the east. It's got a big bit of a different shape than observed. And then finally, look at one thing that's kind of interesting. When we look at Antarctica, and bear in mind we only got a couple of stations down here to do this, the model output, the synthetic output, shows us something that's clearly a little bit fast, but we don't see that in the actual data. And we're kind of wondering about this Antarctic slab now. It's possible that it hasn't really subducted all that much, and it's actually just sitting here as kind of a shallow curtain. And that's the way I've drawn the picture. That's the way I drew the picture way back here. Here. This kind of shallow curtain, not coming down too deep. Okay. So we know this. We can see slabs in the catalog data. We can see slabs even better in more carefully treated data. We can even see gaps in the slabs. What about something that's a little more subtle? And I'm thinking about the discussion that we were having this morning and something that Dave asked me to talk about, which is about mantle plumes. Can we see these things using these sorts of tomographic techniques? And I'm going to make a distinction between what we can do in the lower mantle and what we can do in the upper mantle. All right, so let's start with the upper mantle case first. Here's the simple seismologist's view of upper mantle plume. We've got a cylinder. We don't know how deep it goes down. We'd like to say it goes down to the core mantle boundary, but maybe it doesn't. And there are a couple of different kinds of experiments we could design to look at this kind of thing. Now, this might be, for example, Iceland. And here we might be setting off an explosion in northern Scotland where we don't have any voters. And this might be our station somewhere in eastern North America. And what we're going to hope for is that these rays are going to travel through the plume and somehow show some kind of anomaly over here, which we can use for tomography. And now we come up to an unfortunate physical phenomena called diffraction. Unfortunate for us in this case because it messes up our possibility of seeing this sort of doing this kind of experiment, seeing this sort of plume. Imagine now we're looking at a cross-section through the plume. This is a horizontal cross-section through the plume. We set off the explosions or the earthquakes happened over here, and the waves are traveling in this direction, and they're going to basically go right across this plume conduit, and we're going to look at what happens to those waves. Now, the plume conduit relative to the surrounding mantle, if it really is a hotspot, should be warm and should be seismically slow. And so that should actually retard the waves that have to cross it. We're going to get these sorts of waveforms. But at the same time that that's happening, so that we're going to end up with this wave basically having a wave front there that's fast relative to a wave front here that's kind of slow, we're also going to produce diffraction around the side of the plume and constructive interference, and the two things together coming from both sides are going to actually accomplish this thing called wave front healing, which is going to make the seismic signal of our plume diminish as we get further and further away. And by the time we get out here, the travel time difference between the part of the wave that's gone through the plume and the part of the wave that didn't is nominal. It's enough that we can't really see plumes this way. Okay? What about this experiment? Well, we've got plenty of really distant earthquakes, and they could send waves which are going to travel a significant fraction of their path in the plume. Those we should see, and we do see travel time anomalies from those. Here's another picture from here's a picture from John Vandekar. I apologize again. These are two maps at 100 kilometers depth, two maps at 300 kilometers depth. These are P waves. These are S waves. The scale is plus or minus 5, plus or minus 2.5. And here you can see there's this blob. And John got this published in Nature before he was the editor. See that blob? Here's the cross section going across from here to there and from here to there in P waves, going down to 660, and in S waves. And they interpreted this, John and company interpreted this as waves that propagated up a remnant mantle plume that sits underneath the Paraná Basin and was probably the Tristan da Cunha plume. It's probably the same plume as the Tristan da Cunha plume. And they were fingering it for causing the rifting between Africa and South America. Sticking still in place, an anomaly still in place, down underneath South America, underneath Brazil there. The problem with this is, with waves that have come all the way up through a long vertical plume, you really can't get good resolution of where the base of this thing is. So if you want to start making arguments now about this plume went into the lower mantle, you can't do it. And that's why they've cut the picture off at 660, and there's no way to link this thing to something deeper. Now, given that this is a plume that probably was here 130 million years ago, not many people really expected this thing to go down to the Coromantle boundary. But in any case, if it had, they wouldn't have seen it. They would not have been able to resolve it. All right, let me show you some other pictures which are a little bit better and give you a little bit more idea of what you can do with this kind of tomography. We're going to talk about an African and a Pacific lower mantle superplume. And here's the cross-section lines. They're going right across Africa. That star is this star on the lower left corner of every one of these hemispheres. That's these stars. And here's the velocity scale. These are VS. And you can see that down on the Coromantle boundary, there's something that looks slow and something that looks plume-like in a bunch of different inversions that Barbara Womanowicz and other people have done here. So these are different techniques, basically, to do different tomographies. And it doesn't sort of matter what they do. They always see this thing which looks slow, which they were calling the lower mantle superplume. All right. One thing to think about here is that we can resolve these a bit better in the lower mantle, because when we have earthquakes up here, they dive down and they come through the lower mantle more horizontally than vertically. They're not going on their steep parts of their path. So we get a lot better resolution in many ways down on the lowermost mantle than we would get, say, up here. And so when you see these things where the thing comes up, kind of ends, and doesn't look like it comes and connects to the surface, that's probably really an artifact of rays not doing a sampling for you. Okay? All right. We got to wonder, though, and Barbara wondered, if this seismic velocity is really the observable that we need. Now, I know Dave asked me to talk about teleseismic travel time tomography, but there's something else that maybe geologists ought to start thinking about, and that's attenuation tomography. So let's think about this. When we have waves that come up to different stations, very often we notice that there are strong amplitude anomalies as well as arrival time anomalies. So the waveforms look different depending on where you are. And the reason for that is these waves basically are traveling through different things, and those things are variably attenuative. They change the amplitudes and they change the frequency content depending on where you are. So, for example, we might have cold seismically fast slab, which transmits everything very well seismically, and we end up with a lot of high amplitude, high frequency waves. Or we might have melt lenses, which really take the Mickey out of all our waves, knock them right down, and change their frequencies to basically take away all the high frequencies. So all these different things, including plumes, can have a strong effect on our waves. So Barbara went ahead and she started doing this attenuation tomography. And let me just show you some of those pictures. On the bottom, we have velocity tomography, and on the top, we have this so-called Q tomography. This is attenuation tomography. And when you look at these pictures, what you see is there's a plume that's really pretty well defined in the lower mantle seismically, but when we come up into the upper mantle, it doesn't look like it gets in there. When we look at Q, though, this attenuation, we can see that there's a region which matches basically the top of this thing, which looks like it is attenuative, highly attenuative. So in other words, well, you can start thinking about that as something which is hot. Here's two more pictures. This is no longer the African superplume, but the South Pacific swell. Here you see the anomaly in map view. They've got two cross sections here. And again, she's showing velocities on the bottom and Q on the top. And when you look at these, you can see these structures coming right up through the upper mantle as a strong signal in attenuation, although there's not much signal in velocity. Here's S wave velocity, and you can see these are the same areas, the same cross sections, two different techniques, velocity on the top and attenuation on the bottom. You can see the plume, their interpreted plume, very well in attenuation. You don't see anything in velocity. Okay. All right, so let's finish. What part of these pictures can we actually image? Have we actually imaged? I would argue we can see slabs well. We can see slabs well, and we can see them sometimes going into the lower mantle. I don't think we've ever really seen a picture like this. We can see some things that look like big red blobs on the coromantle boundary that make us think, because we're conditioned to think about convective overturn, that they're upwellings. Maybe they are, maybe they're not, whatever. We know there's big red, seismically slow blobs down there. We've imaged those things. So yes. The interpretive parts of this, some things really must be happening. This downward sort of trajectory of slabs, that's for sure happening. Is the upward thing happening? Well, we don't really know, right? It's not entirely clear. And then finally, I'd just like to say we don't live in a 2D Earth. All these pictures, these interpretive pictures, are 2D pictures. We live on a 3D Earth. And we're going to have to get to the point somehow where with visualizations or something, we take these tomos in there and we make them fully 3D so that people can actually see the actual dynamics in the pictures rather than having to have these little arrows. And bear in mind, a lot of what actually happens here isn't vertically only. It's going in and out of the plane of these pages. The flow field is probably much more complex than this. I think I'll stop there, and if anybody has any questions, I'd be very happy to answer.
Ray, there's a few on the discussion line. One at the top from Pamela Burnley. Do you see that?
Does the vertical uncertainty become horizontal uncertainty at the bottom of the tomographic images? Yes. In general, that's going to be the case because you have poor resolution where all your rays are parallel, and when you're doing those lower mantle tomographies using, you know, diffracted S or S waves that are grazing the core, those things, they're all parallel. So where you put those things, you need lots and lots of crossing rays. If you've got a good distribution, you can do better, but you're going to be inherently in that situation. Yes, I agree. Let's see, what else? Could you write a guide for non-seismologists as how to gauge honest tomographers? You got to look them in the eye and stamp on their feet and make them come clean. humans are predisposed to see patterns even when they don't exist. How do we teach students about scientific approaches to test our pattern recognition tendencies? Good question. I'm always a big believer in once burned, twice shy with this kind of thing. And I think it might be really interesting to see if an activity could be defined where the students are given some image and told to interpret it, and then maybe told to test that image and show that what they've been interpreting is actually spurious. That might be a good way to do something like that. Could you expand on why attenuation tomo is more sensitive to plumes than travel times? The attenuation features are very, very strong when the seismic waves, particularly S waves, are forced to go through things that are materials that are near melting or near solidus. And that's a much stronger effect on the waveforms and the frequency content than the overall slowing down of the wave due to the same temperature change, for example. And then furthermore, and this is even better, everybody who worries about red-eyed and blue-eyed always has this either-or interpretive framework. It's either temperature or it's composition or it's some combination of the two. Q isn't fooled by composition. The attenuation is strictly a thermal phenomenon. It can't be affected strongly by the earth materials, the attenuation in earth materials. So it's a better gauge, I think. So many questions, I'll limit myself. 2, can you summarize the seismology community's perspective on banana donut tomography? To what degree are only shown cherry-picked inversion results? The banana donut thing, I think, is definitely the wave of the future. It's actually the wave of the present.
You want to define that just a little bit for everybody?
Sure. Yesterday, Gene showed a nice picture where he showed you how that P wave coming up to a station really looked like a cone, a narrow cone, and the S wave really looked like a big fat cone. Do you remember that picture? Okay, if you've got that picture in your mind, those are the bananas of sensitivity for travel time. So anywhere in that cone is potentially contributing to your travel time anomaly at the station. And the donut part comes in when you think about the cross sections of those cones. They have a hole in the middle because directly along the ray you've got actually low time sensitivity. Okay, so what do? When you want to redistribute the time information that you observed at the surface back along rays now, you can't do it along that thin theoretical ray that I've been showing. You have to do it by distributing those times through a volume. And that's why we talk about this finite frequency. You take a bunch of different tomographies, you take the data, you filter it at a bunch of different frequencies, and you run the tomographies, and you look at a kind of a combined result to see what are the things that actually give you the same picture basically every time. So that's the banana donut thing. Brendan, I don't think there's any question that everybody's going to be doing this if they're not already doing this. I think it's a sealed deal. And then to what degree are only shown cherry-picked inversion results? You have to look at each individual case individually. I think Gene is a great scientist, and I love the talk he gave yesterday, and one that I've seen a bunch of other times too. But he also had to say, you know, in some instances, this is my favorite anomaly, and I don't want to talk about that other one. They're there. I mean, they are there. There are things that are there that we don't necessarily know how to interpret, and we're going to need more information in order to basically decide if those are artifacts or if they're really, really, truly things that we have to try to take a stab at. How's that?
Well, I think maybe just because of the time, we might begin to wrap up, and maybe people will think of more questions for you this afternoon and this evening, and we can discuss them further. But I want to just thank you a lot for that fantastic tutorial. That was really great. Lots to think about.
Well, glad to do it. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay, and I think we're going to turn over first to Dave Moak.
Okay.
Dave, are you on?
Yeah. I am. That was absolutely fantastic, and maybe even a mineralogist like I can start understanding redite and blueite again. So, John or Monica, could you go to the program for just a minute, please?
Yeah, will do.
And if you just scroll down to Thursday. Anyway, so it's now time for us to get to work. And we've had some really great ideas, both on the science side. We've had some great contributions coming on the threaded discussions about what types of activities might be pursued, a little bit about what is needed, a lot of people looking for help in a lot of important areas. I would like to remind you that we do have a link to something we call Hot Topics, and that's something that Mike and Kathy and I had put together before the workshop, just looking at the literature, going to GSA meetings, going to the Earthscope meeting, and just trying to find those topics that seem to be just way cool, but that need to be jump-started and somehow developed for incorporation into our teaching activity. So given all of these great ideas about teaching, this is your homework for the night. First of all, you'll note on the program there's another threaded discussion. And this is time for you to take a deep breath and say, okay, for the next couple of days over the weekend and into next week, I'm going to be working and developing an activity on, and you fill in the blank. And it would be really great if you all could do this and respond, because early tomorrow morning I will be trying to organize these into working groups so that you will have a cadre of people that you can bounce ideas off, share resources, just enter into a conversation as if you're walking down the hall and walking into your colleague's office. And the other thing that we're going to ask you to do is to start developing this activity on a new activity sheet. And John is going to give us a walkthrough on the activity sheets in just a second. But just for background, for those of you who have used our resources at Cutting Edge, you know that we always try to frame the activity in terms of the context in which we hope it will be used. We ask for a brief description. We ask for a clear articulation of the learning goals. And then you can simply upload the activities, which may be Word files, PDFs, JPEGs, and so on. And John will show us how to do that in just a minute. But the basic idea is that we would like people to start working on a new activity sheet and start to define for us what the project is that you would like to work on, what just a brief description about the project, who the intended audience is, and then that'll set the stage for more focused work over the weekend and early next week. So, John, I'm going to hand it over to you, and John's going to give us a brief walkthrough just to show us how to access the activity sheets and how to start creating the activity. So go ahead, John.
Okay, so from this part of the program, what you're going to want to do is Well, like Dave was said, here's a link to the new threaded discussion where you guys can talk about the thing that you want to create. That'll take you right to that particular thread. This link here under the homework will take you to a form that will help you format the place where you're starting to make your activity. So if we click there, we get a page that's about submitting a teaching activity. So there's some introductory text about the process that you're going to go through at the top. And then further down the page, you start getting into fields that you'll fill in about your activity. At this early stage, we don't expect you to have huge amounts of this detail already worked out, but your name, obviously, the stuff about you, and some general stuff about your activity that you're wanting to create are what we're looking for to kind of set the stage. So you'll enter your name, your activity title. Further down here, you will enter the goals of your activity or assignment, and then a description. Here you can see a place to put the description. That's kind of the baseline that we're looking for at this point. If you have some of these other things, maybe you want to put some notes to yourself in some of these other fields of things that you are going to want to include later. That's probably a really good idea because this will keep it all together in one place. So when you've gotten as far as you're going to get, at the very bottom of the page, if I don't know that you'll be at a point where you're able to do this at this point, but there is a place here where you can upload activity sheets, supporting materials. This is likely not the place, not the time when you're going to be ready to do that, but this is, if you have some of these things that you want to add in, this is a place where you can do it. You can click on one of these places to select a file and upload it along with the other things that you're uploading if you want to keep some stuff all in one place. But at the very bottom, you'll have a submit button, and hit that for sure once you've gotten all the information that you want to get into this initial draft. So at that point, you will have created an entry in our example database. To access that later on, you are going to have a CERC account, which we talked about on the technical page in the workshop. Just in general, how many folks have made CERC accounts if they didn't already have one? Can you just show a show of hands or a checkbox or something like that? Fantastic. It looks like most everybody has. If you haven't, you need to do that basically now, or in short order. How's that? Because what we want to do, once you make your account, you'll be able to then look at the bare bones of things that you've uploaded. And what you're going to do is you're going to go to this same link that you used to make your account. You're going to go there. This will be for my account. And on this page, you'll see in this area here, there will be a link that will have the title that you just input as the title of your proto activity. And when you click on that link, you'll get something like this. This is not in the, yours will have a different look. This is just the one that was sitting in my account to test with. So you'll have all of these headings there, and any information that you typed into one of the fields will be here. There will be links to files that you uploaded, that kind of thing will all be right here on the screen. And if you want to dive right in and start editing what you've got on here, there's a little edit link here in the top right corner of the page. And when you do that, then each of these fields, once you click on them, becomes an editable thing. And then you can click the Save button, and you'll see if you then exit the editing mode, you'll see that your changes are there on top of the page. So that's kind of the briefest intro to how you're going to go about doing an actual activity piece of this. If some of you are interested in doing more extensive web pages, we can create space for you guys to work in that. But I think at this point, we were just going to talk about the actual activity piece of this. Is that right, Dave?
Yeah, and if I could just supplement a little bit about what John said. John, can you go back to the first interface where we're going to create an activity page?
Yep.
An activity sheet? For the first time, when you go to access this system, what will happen is you will type in to the little boxes whatever information is requested. There we go. And then the other thing is make sure you hit submit. So can you scroll down, John? The submit should be right at the bottom. Please do this because your information will be lost at the end of the session if you don't submit. So please do this. Anyway, what happens next is this information will be transferred into the activity sheet that John just showed you. And John, is that automatic, or are you and Monica, are you manually making the activity sheets?
As soon as they hit submit, they can go to their account page and see that link to their new activity. It's automatic.
Okay, great. And then, so once you do this first step and create the page, then, as John showed us, you can call up your page, hit the edit button, and then you are free to type away. And for now, Monica advises us to just go ahead and use standard text. We can help with formatting a bit later. And then tomorrow afternoon, we'll show you a few more tricks. If you want to, for example, decorate your page with an image, that's very easily done. We can help you upload a file that will be a supplement to your activity. That's very easily done. And you can go back and simply re-edit the text.
And I'm and if anybody gets into doing this and they have a specific question for me or on how to do anything, feel free to email me directly. Between Monica and I, we can field all those kinds of individual things as well as kind of the global how do you edit this thing kind of questions.
And then, John, could you go back to the edit box? Glenn just asked, if you go to your activity sheet, and Glenn just asked a question, can we edit directly in HTML? Yeah, please hit the edit box. And on my screen, the image isn't big enough, so I had to use the scroll bar on the bottom to get over to see the box on the far right. There is, for example, the help FAQ that gives all the commands that you could possibly want to know about. If you want to bold, italicize, if you want to build in internal HTML links, things like that, all of the advice that you need is there, but we'll go over that in more detail tomorrow. And then if you want to see your creation, you can hit view in a new window. I don't think we need to do that, but okay, there we go. And that's what your page is. So after you do a little bit of work, save early, save often, and you can check out to see how it goes. And then on the full editing tools, Glenn, this is where you can choose to just enter text at the low level. And then, John, can you put us on the switch to HTML view? If you're comfortable programming in HTML, that's where you could do it, Glenn, if you choose to. Anyway, are there any questions about how to access this site and how to set up a page? And then, if not, I think that we're done for the day. So, John, maybe we should go back to the Illuminate screen and see if there are any questions. Let's see. I don't see any other questions. So, that's your charge. Go out, buy yourself a latte, sit down and think for a minute or two, and see what type of activity you'd like to submit. And also, if there's somebody that you want to work with, Monica and John, we should probably send out, like we did for the last workshop, a list of email contacts. So if you want to contact a colleague directly and say, hey, you want to get together and work on something, we'll give you those direct email contacts in the next couple of hours. We'll get that together.
Sure thing.
So, hearing no objections.
Brennan said something about a question coming. I wonder if he wants to just unmute and ask it, or is it going to...
Yeah, sure. Let's do it that way. Brennan, can you... can you patch in?
Brennan here.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I was just wanting to be absolutely clear about what you're hoping us to do now. That's contributing to both the discussion, talking a bit about what we're going to be doing, and working in our own individual activity space.
Yes, please do both. And the reason is everybody can see the discussion thread, so we'll have an idea of the coverage of the types of things that people want to work on. And then if you would make a first pass at the activity sheet, that gives us the basis for formulating the help that we can give you over the next couple of days, because we'll have a better idea of where you're going.
Right, and it's possible that if two people are really starting to work on the same thing, one of those activity spaces might be dropped, and then they'll sort of merge their efforts as we go forward?
Yeah, we could do that. Or Monica or John, can we there's a place to put a second author onto an activity sheet, and that gives permissions, right?
Yes, we can do that. Let's see. We can add that in at any point if you decide that you want to do that.
Let's see. One warning about that: if you have two people editing a page, whoever pushes the save button first wins.
No, and last.
Ahead, wins. I mean. Pardon?
It's he who saves last wins.
That's right. So just be sure you coordinate with your co-author. If one person is editing and making changes, just make sure you're not overprinting each other's work. So, Pam, there's a question about a request for a multi-anvil tutorial. Yes, it certainly does. And after the Compress meeting, I actually had one person volunteer to do this tutorial, but they backed out. I have the template set up, and so maybe I should be in touch with you directly, show you what that looks like, and then if you'd like to do that, I can get you going on that. Let's see. Any other thoughts or questions?
I don't see any other ones.
Okay. So why don't we adjourn for the day? And tomorrow we're going to refine our view a bit more and look at some practical advice and examples of teaching about Deep Earth. And we've got Ed Garnero going to give us some examples about how he teaches with visualizations. Vince, I think, is going to talk about his intro course, and Abby's going to be talking more about earth materials in mineral science. And then we'll take a break in the afternoon. I'll give a little more background about developing the activities, and then we'll adjourn for the weekend. So I think we're good to go, and I'd like to thank the speakers again. Fantastic job. And thanks to all the participants for joining us. And let's give a round of applause. I see they're coming in.
And everybody, jump on the discussion threads if you have ideas about activities and things that you want feedback from.
And certainly send a note to John, myself, Mike, if you have any questions that you want to have answered offline. Okay. Well, we'll see you all for a 10 o'clock Central Time start tomorrow, and we'll do it again.
Thanks a lot, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.